Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
My guest today, whom I won't quite name yet, is a genuine scientist, a genuinely courageous physician, a man I've had on the show in the past, and we're already planning again for the future, because he will bring you data on psychiatric drugs, and in particular, the antidepressant drugs, and in particular, the SSRIs, Prozac, Celexa, Lexapro, Paxil, Zoloft, bring you information about its effects on the unborn, the born, the pregnant mother, the nursing mother, and future generations. We may not even get it all in today, but we'll have him back regularly. Before going to this very esteemed physician, let me tell you that you can get together with me in warm, sunshiny weather, February 27th and 28th, coming up, and March 1st, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, the organization founded by me and Ginger. We are co-running a conference with the Florida Adlerian Society. We're co-running their 2014 meeting on February 27th, which is a Thursday. There'll be a lot about psychology and Adlerian psychology. On February 28th, the Friday, not far from now, I will start off presenting, and then I will MC the entire day, very much as I do when we give conferences alone. And the group that I'll be emceeing will include a judge who helps children come off drugs. What do you think of that? And a school that has no children with ADHD, even if they come in with it. And then on Saturday, I'll be doing a workshop, and I'll be covering all the stuff that people are interested in hearing me talk about, from the dangers of drugs, to coming off the drugs, to better alternatives. How do we really help people? What is a healing presence? How do we avoid burning out? How do we really care? So take a look. You can go to the website of empathictherapy.org. That's ours, empathictherapy.org, and see the, I think it's green, a little box, and that takes you right to all the details that you need. Certainly on Friday and Saturday, anyone who would come to our regular conferences where we used to give them alone, more and more with co-sponsoring and co-running things, check it out. Check it out at empathictherapy.org. Now, my guest today. My guest is Adam Urato. Adam, are you there?
I am here, Peter.
Hi.
Hello.
Me introduce you, say a few kind words about you. Adam is a department chair of obstetrics and gynecology at Metro West Medical Center in Boston, specializes in maternal fetal medicine. Listen to that, folks. This is a man who knows stuff. Maternal fetal medicine, providing expert medical care and guidance for routine and high-risk pregnancies. Adam and I have in common, we both were undergraduates at Harvard. He has in uncommon with me that he went on to Harvard Medical School, whereas I went on to Case Western Reserve. Adam has a lot to talk about today. Glue your ear if you can't hear it all. Follow it on our archives. Tell your friends about it. Urato is spelled U-R-A-T-O. Adam, welcome to the show, and give us kind of a summary of what you want to talk about today.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here with you again, and I wanted to thank you for having me back, and also for your kind introduction, and also again thank you for all of the attention and the information that you've brought to this area in the past and currently. As far as the overview goes, I'm going to use this opportunity to go into the issue of antidepressant use during pregnancy, as well as a few special areas where there has been some active research and some recent scientific papers, including the issues of antidepressant use during pregnancy and how that's related to a few complications. For example, a complication called persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn, a lung problem in newborn babies. We'll also talk about the issue of antidepressant use during pregnancy and autism, the development of autism in the offspring, and also the impact on sexual function and the possible impact on future sexual function and behavior for children who are exposed in utero. So we'll have a lot of ground to cover.
That's really good. Good stuff. Well, begin, sir. I'm going to do a lot of listening today.
If I can start off, I'd say that when we look at this problem as a human community, we look and we say, we've got pregnant women who are depressed. We've got a group of depressed pregnant women. Depression is relatively common in pregnancy. The numbers are kind of all over the place, but it's in the 10 to 20% range. So we've got this group of pregnant women who are depressed. And then the question becomes what to do for them. You don't want to ignore them. We don't want to ignore people who have this. So the idea is to try to provide help to them, to treat them. But how do we do that? Now, what we want to be true and what has kind of, I don't want to say what we want to be true, but what's been sold to us, the conventional wisdom, and I'm going to talk for a moment about the conventional wisdom because it's been a very strong kind of what I would say is wishful thinking. The conventional wisdom or the wishful thinking on this is that pregnant women struggling with depression need to be treated with medication in the same way that we treat women who are pregnant who are diabetics, we treat them with insulin. That's been the conventional wisdom. And that argument or that theory is that if you control the depression with the medication, like you would control diabetes with insulin, then you'll end up getting better outcomes. You'll end up with better, healthier pregnancies. The babies will do better and the moms will do better. This has been what has been hoped for. This has been what I would say is the wishful thinking that we'd hoped for years. And we've been using now Prozac, Zoloft, the other SSRIs. We've been using them since the late 80s. So it's been about 25 years since we've been using this class of drugs in particular, the SSRIs, which is what I'll be focusing on. So this is sort of the wishful thinking, the background. But what we see, in fact, is that that's not at all what's happening. So we've now got roughly 25 years worth of accumulated evidence where we can look at the scientific papers and we can say what's actually happening. We know what the wishful thinking is. We know that we hope that by treating depressed pregnant women with SSRIs, with antidepressants, that it'll improve their health, it'll improve their pregnancy outcomes, but now we can ask what's actually happening. And what we're finding is that we're seeing a whole host of complications in pregnant women who take antidepressants, and particularly the SSRI antidepressants during pregnancy. Some of those complications include things like miscarriage, losing the baby early along in the pregnancy. We see increased rates of birth defects, in particular cardiac defects or heart defects. We see increased rates of preterm birth. Now, preterm birth is a major issue. It's probably the most important issue facing obstetrics in pregnancy today, this issue of babies coming too early. And the SSRIs appear to increase those rates of preterm birth. We also see increased rates of preeclampsia, which is a disease that leads to high, characterized by high blood pressure, protein in the urine, poor outcomes. We see increased rates of that in the women who use SSRIs. And then there's the whole issue of newborn problems. So we know immediately after the babies are born, we see something called the newborn behavioral syndrome. And this is a constellation of symptoms with things such as irritability, difficulty being consoled, constant crying, difficulty feeding, sometimes repetitive motions or repetitive movements. All in all, it's a difficult time period for the newborn when they've been exposed to these medications. Sometimes it can be quite severe, trouble breathing, seizures, and we see vastly increased rates of these newborn problems in babies who are exposed to the SSRI antidepressants during pregnancy. Then the big issue that's starting to emerge is, and I'm going to get into this a little bit today, is what are the possible long-term problems that can be caused by exposure to these medications during development. So serotonin is a neurotransmitter which is crucial for development. It's crucial not just for brain development, but also for development of many organ systems. And we're starting to see concerning findings that children, offspring, and animal studies who are exposed to these drugs during development can develop problems down the line, problems that include things like lung problems, problems that include autism or neurobehavioral abnormalities, problems that may include things like altered sexual function. So stepping back now, we look at it and we can say, okay, we were hoping that treatment of depression during pregnancy, we were hoping that it might follow the same model as treatment of diabetes. But what we're seeing in reality is nothing of the sort. We're not seeing that at all. We're seeing increased rates of complications and no evidence of benefit in the women who are on these medications during pregnancy. It's interesting for me, Pete. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going
to
ask you.
I know you'd like to take a breather at some point. I'm just happy to hear you talk. So if you're not ready for a breather yet, please, Adam Murato, continue.
I was going to ask you, Peter, that you also must see this or must have seen this in your years of discussing these agents, this comparison to insulin and diabetes, which has been a very strong, I would say, selling point for the medication, this comparison that we need to be treating depression with these in the same way we treat diabetes with insulin.
Yeah, it is very important. I think I actually began ridiculing that concept probably as far back as toxic psychiatry. Well, there's many things to say about it, but briefly, well, there is no disease process that we know of, whereas in diabetes, there are problems with the islands of Langerhans producing insulin. There are problems with resistance to insulin in the cells in the body. We have a disease process that responds to some extent, but not completely, to various medications, including those that add insulin through injection into the blood stream. Mm-hmm. So there's a real disease process, and there's a specific measurable improvement from a specific intervention. And, of course, in the psychiatric disorders, and depression being one example, there's no known underlying disease. It's almost surely not a disease at all. It's a phenomena of social relationships, and it may also have to do with how a woman feels when her hormones are changing and there's big stresses. She's wondering if her husband's going to be there, if she has a husband to help support, and what it's going to be like seeing mom with the baby and so on and so forth. There's just a ton of reasons why people would experience emotional stress, anxiety, depression during pregnancy.
Sure.
The second thing is that's so ironic is that, in fact, from medical school on, even in the 60s when I was in med school, the diabetic doctors were far more person-centered than the psychiatrists back in the 60s, and that's continued to this day. Because the first thing a genuine endocrinologist or genuine doc treating people for insulin, for diabetes wants to do is to see, can we change your lifestyle? Can you exercise more? Can you get some help with your emotional stresses? Can you learn to eat better? Whereas psychiatrists who treat nothing but lifestyle disorders treat them like fake physical disorders and don't show the same respect that a diabetes doctor is going to show for the individual's personal responsibility. So it's incredibly ironic.
Yeah.
The second thing I wanted to address, and then I'm not going to address the autism issue yet, but when the baby is born, and this is a question and a thought, when the baby's born with this syndrome following the mom being treated with SSRIs, and I'm going to assume the baby's not nursing and getting SSRIs, which is another problem. Do you think we're seeing mostly toxicity in this syndrome or mostly withdrawal or both?
That's a great question, and it still continues to try to be sorted out by the researchers that are looking at this. And I think it's probably some element of both. Initially, people were calling it withdrawal syndrome, and it was felt to be as a result of the baby basically coming off of the SSRI medications after birth. But it's being noted now that some of these symptoms show up early after birth, which would be too early for withdrawal, and that it might in fact relate to direct hyperserotonemia, direct serotonergic stimulation from the medications themselves. And the current thinking on this is mixed, that it's believed to be some element of both a direct sort of toxic effect and then also a withdrawal effect over time. I wanted to say, though, I think you make a terrific point about the issues with lifestyle changes first, and I think that does, you know, speak to a difference in the approach. The other thing I just wanted to comment on, going back to the diabetes and insulin, is that we see dramatic improvements in pregnancy outcomes with the use of insulin, and that should be noted. When you look back at the history of obstetrics and pregnancy, women who were insulin-requiring diabetics before insulin was around and had severe diabetes, they would have awful pregnancy outcomes. They would have many more miscarriages. If they did successfully continue to carry the pregnancy, the rates of birth defects were very high. And then as those continued on, the rates of pregnancy complications were high. This is in women who are diabetic without insulin. By controlling them properly, by using insulin properly in these women, we've really been able to have miraculous effects on pregnancy and tremendous benefit to these pregnancies. And that's easy to show in the data. If you look at this, if you do the study, you see that the women on the insulin, the diabetics on the insulin, do better than the diabetics who are uncontrolled, who are not taking insulin. But in the case of depression and antidepressants, it's the opposite. It's the women on the medications who are doing worse, who are having the worse in pregnancy outcomes.
And probably they're not getting less depressed, because one thing we know now from a series of meta-analyses of FDA data is that if you go beyond just the cherry-picked results from the drug companies and look at all the drug company studies, what I said from the very, very beginning in talking back to Prozac, these drugs don't work. They don't work. They flatten emotions. They dull people. They have a placebo effect. They do not lift depression.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that the public knowledge is increasing in this area, and certainly Dr. Irving Kirsch contributed a lot to that by looking at this data, by getting all of the FDA data and presenting all of the studies. And when you look at that, the difference between drug and placebo is likely of little clinical significance for most patients on these, and that's the real tragedy here.
Let me interject, because not only is there little or no difference in how well they're doing, you're guaranteed that the people on the drugs are doing much worse because of the horrendous long-term side effects from the drugs that the placebo people aren't going to get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that kind of decision-making or that fact, the point that you just made has particular relevance with pregnancy, because you're not just then dealing with awful side effects for the individual, which are awful, but you're also then dealing with all of these ramifications of exposure to the pregnancy and to the developing baby.
Well, let's go on to your next subject. I mean, there's autism, there's the sexual changes. Pick up on what you'd like to talk to, Dr. Urato.
Sure. I think I'll probably start with the paper that just came out. So the British Medical Journal last week published a paper on the issue of persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. So it's got a long, fancy name, PPHN. What it refers to, persistent pulmonary hypertension in the newborn, is that the baby that has that disease has altered blood flow to the lungs. And this is a very serious condition that has a very high rate of death in babies who are affected by it. And as far back as 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, initial papers started to come out showing that women who took SSRIs during pregnancy appeared to have an increased risk of babies with this condition called PPHN. And it was on that basis that in 2006, the FDA issued a warning saying that these drugs, this class of drugs, the SSRIs, when used by pregnant women, appear to increase the rates of persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. Subsequent studies over the next few years came out that created somewhat of a mixed picture, although many of us who were reading those studies felt that the studies that showed that there was a problem with the SSRIs and PPHN were better done studies, and that the studies showing no effect or that they didn't cause PPHN were actually not quite as good. But looking at all of the data, the FDA in 2012, and what many, I think, look at as a mistake, came out and essentially went back on the warning about using SSRIs in pregnancy and this disease. So that made this paper that just came out last week in the British Medical Journal particularly relevant and particularly important. This group of researchers from Canada, they looked at all of the studies in total to see if they could find an association, and they did find, yes, that using the SSRI antidepressants during pregnancy is associated with this disease of persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. And I think it's particularly important because not only is this a fatal disease, PPHN, for newborn babies, but it also speaks to one of the earlier issues that I was talking about, which is that serotonin has very important effects in development that go beyond the brain. We tend to think of these SSRIs and other psychotropic drugs as affecting the brain, but serotonin is a vital neurotransmitter for a developing embryo and fetus, and it helps and it's crucial in development of not just the brain, but the lungs, the intestines, basically all of the important, the heart, all of the important body systems. And we're seeing now that that the babies who were exposed can be and often are affected in other systems. And that's why I think this persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn paper was important. One other point I wanted to make on this paper was that the authors themselves sort of downplayed their own findings. And one of the issues that they downplayed is that they said that persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn as a result from SSRIs may lead to an increased rate of death in the babies. But then they tried to compare that to the rates of maternal suicide, essentially, I think, making an argument. By juxtaposing those two, they were making an argument that you really need to be considering maternal suicide on the other side of this, and that's why it's important to use the SSRIs. But and again, this is an area that I think, Peter, you can speak to. It looks like the data actually points to in the direction of increased suicidality with the use of SSRIs as opposed to a protective effect. Would you agree with that?
Oh, this is no doubt about it. The FDA has warned about a doubling of the attempted suicide rate and suicidal ideation in these little short-term studies of children and youth up to age 24. But it's actually all ages. I'm involved right now in a suicide case, and I've been going several suicide cases, and I've been going through the Celexa and Lexapro data to the FDA, and the reports on completed suicide are just staggering on both those drugs, and they are mostly for adults right across the board. And we also have epidemiological studies showing all ages are afflicted. Yeah, these drugs, it's easy to show these drugs cause suicidal behavior and practically impossible to show they work. What a bizarre situation.
Yeah, this is an important issue for me, Peter, because when I lecture on this topic, inevitably I will get asked by someone will make the point that, you know, you're saying that these drugs have all of these downside effects in pregnancy, more miscarriage, more birth defects, more preterm birth, but then they'll make the point, but look, we don't want women out there killing themselves. You know, that's the flip side argument that people will often make to say that we need to have young people on these drugs. And I find myself oftentimes explaining to the audience that no, it seems like that might be the case, but that's not actually what the data is showing. It's not showing decreased suicidality. It's actually showing increased suicidality with the use of these medications.
And many other psychoactive substances do that. We're going to be coming to a break in a minute or two, and I just thought I'd do something I don't often do here, which is just let my audience know, and Adam and I were talking about this, that the word's getting out, and that I'm doing a lot to get the word out. You're, of course, listening to my radio show here. We don't have millions of listeners. We have a lot. We're way up there in among Internet radio shows. But yesterday, to give you an example, I probably spoke to 10 million people or more on the radio about these issues. I'm the resident psychiatrist on George Norrie's Coast to Coast, which is by far the largest evening radio show. It starts at 10 p.m. on the West Coast and obviously 1 a.m. here. And every week or two, I have a news report at 1 a.m. my time, and occasionally I'll go on for an hour. And I was got a call last night. I was on George Norrie, and also I got a call from Michael Savage, the very conservative daytime host who has a lot of listeners. I'm sure it's in the millions. And I think between these two shows, I probably talked to 10 million people, and of course, get great reception from the show hosts. So the word is getting out there. Adam, is there anything you want to cover in the next 2 minutes?
Absolutely. Two minutes may be a little short on it, but I would say
then we're going to go to a half-hour break. I mean, no, we're going to go to a short break and then another half-hour.
The one other point I was going to make, which we'll be getting into later in the discussion, I think, though, is that the human data is showing us what the animal studies have shown, and that's another point that many researchers and many people are missing on this, is that people say, well, we don't know if it's the depression causing these problems or if it's the antidepressant, but if we look at the animal studies, we're finding many of these same complications that with the use of SSRIs during development, whether it's rats or mice or sheep, which we're then seeing in the human studies. So I just think it's important for people. We don't experiment on humans in the same way, or not in a laboratory sense, but it's important to pay attention to some of this animal data.
Yeah, it's very confirmatory. I mean, it's very similar to what we're seeing, for example, with the giving antipsychotic drugs to people who get labeled schizophrenic. Well, it's turning out that these folks have shrinkage of the brain. They lose brain cells and brain mass over a period of months, not years, months. And you
Absolutely.
Say, well, was that schizophrenia? Well, no, of course, it's never been schizophrenia. And besides, you get the same results in animals, the same results in normal
animals.
That's exactly right. And I think in this case, we see the going back to this last case, but certainly with the fetal lungs, we see that when we do these studies in animals, that by exposing them to these SSRIs during their development, they develop PPHN. They develop this persistent pulmonary hypertension in the newborn. So then when we use them in humans and we see the same thing, to then make the argument that, well, maybe it's the depression doing that, it's just far-fetched. It's
Adam, we're going to go to break now. You'll hear our music starting. We're talking with Adam Urato, U-R-A-T-O, Harvard Medical School, Harvard College, a magnificent physician, a brave scientist. I'm so glad you're on the show.
Thank you, Peter.
And this is Peter Bregan, back with my magnificent guest, Adam Urato, U-R-A-T-O, Department Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Metro West Medical Center in the Boston area. And by the way, it's quite a surprise to hear my show advertised on my show. Not my idea. I imagine they're sort of randomly advertising it, and I'm glad to hear they are. but it's a surprise to hear it pop up in the middle of this show. Adam, let me ask you a quick question before going into this stuff I know you want to talk about. Is there more data on the effect of nursing mothers passing on antidepressants to the nursing infant?
It's a great question, Peter, and it's a great question, and it's an interesting question because it really seems to be very variable. And this is when you really get into the science of milk production in the mom and metabolism of the drug in the mom and metabolism of the drug in the baby. So there is exposure of the babies with breastfeeding. We know that the drug gets into the breast milk. We know that the babies can be exposed. So that's kind of the general answer to the question. When you get into the specifics, though, of how much they're being exposed and what that's going to mean, it becomes a difficult thing to study because every mom, every mother-infant dyad, every mom-infant combination works differently in terms of how the mom metabolizes her drug, how much she passes into the breast milk, how much the baby gets, and then how the baby metabolizes the drug. So there are several case reports showing clear evidence of toxicity where the babies became ill from overexposure to the SSRIs during breastfeeding. And so we know from these cases that for whatever reason, whether it was because of the mom, the way she processed her breast milk, made breast milk, or because of the way the infant failed to process the drug, that you can get significant exposure through breastfeeding. Other infants in other combinations seem to be less affected because it may be that there's less exposure, that there's less getting into the mom's breast milk, the way she processes the drug, and there may just be less exposure to the baby because of the way the baby processes the drug. So it's a bit of a moving target to try to counsel people on it. The general counseling is that, yes, it can be transmitted in breast milk. Yes, there can be newborn effects, but what that's going to mean for an individual mom and baby can be variable.
And folks, all psychiatric drugs, as far as I know, go through the breast milk because, you know, they've got these fluoride ions attached to the drug. Or, you, Adam, you probably know the chemistry better than I do, but they all have to be capable of passing through the blood-brain barrier, and it's a lot easier to get through the placenta and mother's milk. So
sure.
They're all doing this, and you can get babies on lithium who are just outright flaccid, for example.
Sure.
Adam, we're going to talk about at least two more things, and one of them is going to be autism. Another is going to be the sex changes in the unborn that may affect the adult.
Yeah, I'd like to get into that. Hopefully, we'll have time here as the time's drawing near on us. We know that the SSRIs affect sex drive and sexual performance, sexual behavior in adults. This is now crystal clear. And I mean, you could tell me more about this, obviously, Peter, than I could tell you, but I think the estimates are somewhere in the range of 75%, 60, 70, 80% of people taking these may notice sexual effects. I mean, would you agree with that?
I think so. I wouldn't be surprised if long-term everybody, but yes. And, you know, some people are doing, at least from clinical experience, are saying that by no means does everybody recover when the drug is stopped. And that's scary but important to say, that some
Absolutely.
People are getting lasting sexual dysfunctions.
Absolutely. And that leads into what I'm going to be talking about, which is, so we know that these drugs affect sexual sex drive, sex performance in adults. We know about this issue of post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, which is what you're talking about, which appears that in a subset of patients, even after stopping the medication, there can be long-term effects on sexuality, sexual behavior, sexual performance. The question researchers have recently been looking at is whether exposure during development can lead to alterations in sex drive and sexual performance after the organism develops, becomes sexually active. Now, these studies have been done now only in animals. Obviously, we're not doing these experiments in humans, but the results are very concerning. So a lot of this work has been done at the University of Mississippi, and one of the more interesting studies on this came from 2006. There are some more recent studies, but the one from 2006 was interesting. They exposed male rats to Celexa during the 14 days of development that basically corresponds to human development in the third trimester. So what this was designed to do was to give a short exposure to a developing male rat just for 14 days during the developmental period. And then what they did was, when those rats became adults, they compared them to the rats who were unexposed, who got only saline or salt water, basically. And what they found was dramatic. What they do are these sexual incentive tests where they put a fertile female rat in, and what they found is that the male rats who had been exposed to Celexa during the developmental period that corresponds to the third trimester of human development, these rats were less sexually interested. They were less sexually active with the female. I won't get too much into the details, but they essentially were taking longer before mounting the female. There were fewer sexual episodes. They actually they had decreased sexuality, and this decrease in sexuality was pretty dramatic. So the rats that got the saline only during development, these rats would have sexual intercourse, would copulate with the female very quickly, within seconds of exposure to the fertile female. But this was not the case with these rats that had been exposed during development. These rats took longer to interact with the female and often didn't interact with the female, and it was clear that the sexual behavior was different. So what's dramatic about these kind of results is that if this sort of thing happened in adults on SSRIs, you'd say, okay, that is what we see. Adults have decreased sexual behavior, decreased sexual performance on the SSRIs. But these rats were not on the SSRIs at the time of the study. These rats were just exposed during their period of development that corresponds to the third trimester in human development. And so it was a lasting effect. And in other ways, they looked similar to just normal, regular rats. It was something you wouldn't have picked up unless you did this particular sexual incentive motivation test.
And folks, rats, the biology of rats, they're mammals, very,
right.
Very close to ours, very, very close.
This was followed up by a group from Brazil. This group from Brazil wanted to look at a similar question, but they wanted to compare the SSRI with another antidepressant that it looks like does have fewer sexual side effects, bupropion. So in the studies now, bupropion as an antidepressant can have many other adverse effects, but when it comes specifically to sexual side effects, it looks like there is a difference between bupropion and the SSRIs. So this group from Brazil did a similar study to the one I just described. This group from Brazil published their results in 2011, and what they did is they exposed pregnant and they used, I just want to make sure I get the animal correct. They exposed, I believe it was pregnant mice, to either the SSRI or to bupropion. And these were rats, I'm sorry, they used rats. And they exposed the pregnant rats either to the SSRI or to bupropion, Wellbutrin. And then they looked and they did a similar study after these exposed male rats developed. And what they found was, again, fascinating. What they found was that the rats that had been exposed to Celexa or Prozac, citalopram or fluoxetine, that they were much less likely to engage in sexual activities. But they found that the bupropion exposed did not seem to have an impact on the male sexual behavior. So this was very interesting, again showing this SSRI effect during development potentially leading to problems in sexual behavior down the line, and a drug that appears to have possibly less sexual side effects, bupropion, not having that impact. Now, there were other impacts to the bupropion. There were other impacts to the bupropion. Those mice who were exposed during pregnancy, they had some disrupted juvenile play behaviors and things like that. But when it came specifically to the sexual testing, it was clear the difference between the SSRIs.
Yeah, so not even good for rats. I mean, as gross as rat behavior is, you can see the damage. When we get around to studying the long-term effects on human beings of psychiatric drugs, we're going to see a disaster. We're going to see a disaster, folks.
So this is exactly...
Yeah, go ahead, Adam.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Peter. This is exactly my concern, though. I worry that are we going to be seeing, is this like a sexual dysfunction time bomb that we may be seeing down the line? Because we're exposing now, depending on which populations you look at or which papers you look at, anywhere between 3%, 5%. Some studies have gone as high as 13 to 14%. Of pregnancies. That's a lot of pregnancies. There's 4 million babies born in the U.S. each year. So if you're talking about 10%, you're talking about 400,000 exposed pregnancies. And if we're seeing these kind of effects in animal studies, it really does give me concern. When I lecture on this, people will say, well, you know, we're not rats. We're not rats, but they are mammals. And many of the effects that we see in the rat studies and the mice studies and the small mammal studies, we then do see similar effects from the human data. So I don't think it's something that we can ignore. And I think it's something worth being cautious about. What we're seeing here with the alterations in sexual function down the line for mammals who are exposed to these agents in utero.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that, in fact, the rat brain and body is much more resistant to trauma and toxicity for obvious reasons. Look how rats live, and they're much, much simpler than we are, somewhat simpler at least than we are biologically. So, and they're tougher. I mean, for example, one of the things that the shock docs like to do is give a few shocks to a rat brain and say, well, we don't see a lot of damage. Well, the skull is proportionally thicker. The brain is tougher. The fact that these injuries are being picked up in rats means it's going to be almost certainly worse in human beings.
Sure.
Almost certainly.
I think the other thing that scares me, Peter, about this, and you can comment on this, is that I'm concerned that these are effects that it's going to be hard to necessarily point back to the exposure during pregnancy, you may have a 20-year-old 20 years down the line who's having some degree of sexual dysfunction, and are they going to be able to connect the dots and say, you know, this is trouble with what I was exposed to during development? I mean, are we going to pick up on this? We being the human community, the research community, the scientists, this is going to be difficult to sort out over time, the kind of long-term damage and effects that can occur. I mean, when people come to you, are they able to connect the dots that the problem may be a result of the medication, even when it's more direct than an in utero exposure?
Well, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Adam, let's go to spend the last 10 minutes on something we could spend a day on, which is an issue that I think is much more complicated, and that is autism, or what I would call pseudo-autism in my own thinking, produced by these drugs when given to the mother.
Sure. So I'll give the overview. Serotonin, again, is a crucial neurotransmitter for the formation of the brain, for the formation of behavior. And it's also been implicated in autism. One of the key findings in autism is hyperserotonemia. So people have thought that disruption of the serotonin system or alterations in the serotonin system may lead to or is associated with autism. And so there are concerns because of that with the use of these medications during pregnancy. So the first study that came out on this was a study from Kaiser in California. The lead author is Lisa Crowan, and that came out in 2011. And that was really the first study that looked at this, and it showed an increase in autism in children whose moms were exposed to SSRIs during pregnancy. It showed, I believe, a doubling of risk, although the group that was exposed during the first trimester, during early brain formation, appeared to have a more than tripling of risk. And so that was a very concerning paper, and it actually confirmed, again, many of the animal studies which had also shown in rats and mice and small mammals that exposure during development could lead to changes that some described as autistic-like in terms of juvenile play development, socialization, and that sort of thing. So that was 2011. Many people, though, dismissed that study and said, okay, we know there's rat data, and now there's one human study. But then in early 2013, April of 2013, a group from Sweden, the lead author on that study is Rye, and that was in April of 2013, they confirmed the initial findings. They looked at Sweden, and what they found, again, was that the women who were on SSRIs during pregnancy had a more than threefold increase in the rates of autism in their offspring. So this was obviously, it was and is, very concerning. Two more recent studies have just come out, and they both came out of the same database from Denmark. And it's very interesting, these two studies. They're basically using the same database. It's a huge registry of births in Denmark, and both studies use over 600,000 births. It's very interesting, though, because both of the studies did show a trend toward increased rates of autism in the exposed babies, but it did not achieve what's known as statistical significance. What that means scientifically is just that if the researchers aren't 95% sure of their result, then they'll say that they didn't find the result. But I think it got misinterpreted. I think there were a couple of problems in interpretation by the press coverage, which is that we did see in the Denmark database, we did see increased rates of autism in the babies, in the children who were exposed to the SSRIs during pregnancy. We did see that. It did not achieve statistical significance was the thing. The other issue about actually all of these studies is that these are registry studies. And one problem that we have with registry studies is that it's hard to often identify who exactly is or who isn't taking the medication during the pregnancy. And the reason for that is, if I do a study, Peter, just in my community with, say, 10 depressed women that I'm following, I could probably do a pretty good job calling them, doing questionnaires, and figuring out when they were taking their medication or if they were taking medication during pregnancy. It may be a little bit of a challenge. You'd have to call them. You'd have to try to pin down the dates. It may be a little bit of a challenge, but you could probably figure it out. That would be with 10 women. But when you get up to 600,000 women in a registry, it becomes very difficult to pin down who is and who isn't taking the medication. And so what that tends to do in science or in epidemiology, we say that that tends to bias the results towards the null, which is just a fancy way of saying that we tend to underestimate the harmful effects of the SSRIs when we use registry studies. So for me as a researcher and as a maternal fetal medicine physician looking at this, I'm quite concerned that the three databases that have been looked at, which is the Kaiser study from 2011, the Swedish study from 2013, and now the two studies from Denmark in late 2013, are all continuing to point in this direction, in this association of antidepressant use during pregnancy and autism. Now,
Adam,
I know
the...
Go ahead.
Let me break in because we've got maybe 4.5 minutes left, and I want to make a couple of points that I made in talking with you, and then give the mic back to you. I think the studies are very misleading for a number of reasons. One, the women who are getting antidepressants are having emotional issues. They're depressed. That could profoundly affect the early development of their children. The second thing is that the antidepressants produce a flattening of emotions. And if, in fact, as Leo Kanner, who developed the concept of autism, believed that autism was a lack of social development in children due to a lack of socialization by parents, a lack of nurturing or connectivity, so that the children actually didn't develop empathy. They literally didn't develop the ability to relate to their parents differently than, say, to a table or a chair, treated their parents as objects, that this came from the lack of connectivity of the parents. Then, of course, depressed parents and people being flattened by the antidepressants would contribute to the development of autism. But the other thing that I think is extremely important, which I did mention to you when we were talking earlier, and that is that these children are having neurological abnormalities. And autism as an actual disorder, originally defined and seen again and again, is not a neurological disorder. It's a disorder of human relationship. Now they say communication and all that, but it's relationship. The child doesn't learn to relate to human beings as if they're human beings. Now, if you have neurological disorders, that could make it harder for your mother to relate to you. It could make it harder for you to relate to you, relate to your mom. But that the when you're seeing neurological disorders in these children, in these studies, I don't think it's autism. And I think that the reason they're calling it autism is because there's a hugely greater amount of money and fame and press coverage if you say that autism is being caused by these drugs, rather than saying these drugs are just causing neurological disorders and injuring people's brains. Adam, you've got about 40 seconds. Give me a response, my friend, and we are going to be talking again on the show. But please,
Peter, I don't disagree with you about that, and I think autism is a tricky area to study. I've got 2 points to end on. I'm missing my son's two sons' piano and violin lessons to join you this afternoon. I just wanted to say hello to them and tell them to keep playing those instruments. They're terrific musicians. The second thing I wanted to do is to tell you that I think that in general, looking at this topic, we know that given the pregnancy complications with these drugs And given the fact that for most patients who are using them, there doesn't appear to be any evidence of benefit, then really we as a community, as a society, need to emphasize first-line non-drug treatments for patients in general, but in particular women of childbearing age and pregnant women.
I'd say not a single pregnant woman in the world should get an antidepressant. Give her love, surround her with family, help the parents, help the father, help the other children, relate to mom, welcome the pregnancy, welcome her home, wrap around the mom like probably we did when we were living in little villages and in caves.
I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for having me. I'll let you sign off.
Adam Urato, U-R-A-T-O. You can find him on the web. It's an honor to know you, and I'm just so glad to have you on this show, and you'll be coming back again and again, I hope.
Absolutely, Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye, folks.